heating the Sea Life Center with water from the ocean.
It's hard to explain. It doesn't actually seem logical. I'm actually trained as an engineer, and it still doesn't quite make sense to me.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 22nd. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Fairbanks broadcaster remembers the Kennedy assassination.
There was a small red light on the console in front of the announcer, and if it started blinking, that meant major story news bulletin coming in.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
Freezing rain created hazardous driving conditions in south-central Alaska today. By noon, cars were stranded across Anchorage, and the People Mover bus system shut down. Anchorage Police Department spokeswoman Anita Schell says icy road conditions caused major traffic problems.
The majority of our crashes were occurring in the morning hours up until about 2 o'clock, and it seems like it's tapered off right now for the moment. We've had reported 30 accidents today, 3 additional accidents that had minor injuries, and then 46 vehicles in distress, and most of those ended up in a ditch or some other method of breakdown.
People Mover buses resumed their regular schedules around 3 o'clock this afternoon. Icy conditions stretch beyond Anchorage from Seward to as far north as Talkeetna. The Valley Mover bus system in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley is operating on a delayed schedule and plans to make evening runs to help get people back home from work in Anchorage. In the Matsu Borough, there were at least 3 separate school bus accidents this morning, including one where a bus slid onto its side off a road. There were 14 students on board, and 3 reportedly suffered minor injuries. Team Rubicon, the disaster relief NGO made up of retired military personnel, is heading to Kotlik on Monday. The same group has sent volunteers to Haiti, Pakistan, Chile, and most recently the Philippines. It's part of the multi-agency effort to help communities in Western Alaska clean up after a powerful storm 2 weeks ago. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Jeremy Zedek is the public information officer with the Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He explains that Team Rubicon is heading to Kotlik in order to offer support rebuilding damaged property.
To help the community with their cleanup efforts, mucking out homes, doing minor repairs, and restoring access to different parts of the community that are blocked by ice.
The contingent of volunteers was supposed to fly today, but bad weather kept them grounded. The Rubicon group will be staying at a church in Kotlik, preparations for which were made by Red Cross staffers who have been on the ground for almost 2 weeks. The state of Alaska relies on Red Cross personnel to do much of the immediate assistance and relief work following disasters. Laura Spano is the communications manager for the Red Cross in Alaska and says the organization coordinates with government officials during crises.
We were the first, in Kotlik and able to be on the ground and offering that assistance, but we have been side by side with the state through it.
2 people were initially dispatched to Kotlik by the Red Cross and 2 more to Stebbins. They worked on damage assessment, casework, and support services, as well as bringing in water and supplies from across the state. Spano says the Red Cross also dispatched a crisis counselor.
Now we're actually sending a disaster mental health worker out to Stebbins, both for the people that are affected by disaster and our staff that's out there. And we did hear some reports coming back that, maybe that it was a good idea to get someone mobilized quickly and sent out to Stebbins. So that is what we did.
The relief effort in Western Alaska has involved multiple state agencies using different timetables. In Kotlik and Stebbins, the Red Cross has been the first responder, while the state makes longer-term plans for helping the communities recover what was lost in the storms. Zedek says the Department of Homeland Security is currently setting up a phone line for residents in disaster-affected zones to call for help navigating state resources. In Nome, Alaska, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
As energy bills rise for most people across the state, the Alaska Sea Life Centers are actually dropping. That's because they're using the cold waters of Resurrection Bay to heat their building. APRN's Ann Hillman visited the center to find out how it works.
That's Agnes, a 7-month-old sea otter pup who was rescued and sent to the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. She's swimming around a pool with another orphaned otter. The center's marine mammal curator, Derek Woody, says the otters don't have any blubber. They rely on their thick coats of hair to stay warm.
What they do is they groom themselves and they'll blow air into that fur, and it creates like a little bubble of air, almost like a wetsuit to keep them warm in 40-degree water.
That same chilly water rushing into Agnes's pool is also being used to heat most of the building. Tara Reamer-Jones is president of the Sea Life Center.
It's hard to explain. It doesn't actually seem logical. I'm actually trained as an engineer, and it still doesn't quite make sense to me. But effectively, we're running a reverse refrigerator.
The Sea Life Center converted to the seawater heat pump system to save money. Tons of money. In 2008, the center heated with oil, and their energy bill was $1.2 million. Last year, they spent less than half that amount. With savings like that, the entire system will be paid off in 8.5 years.
Being able to reduce our energy costs as much as we have has enabled us to stay successful and be open to the public and keep our costs under control.
So how does it work? Facilities Director Daryl Schaefermeyer takes me to see the system. First, they pump seawater into the building. They already do this to fill tanks and pools for the animals.
Right now, we're probably moving about 3,000 gallons a minute of seawater constantly through the building.
Some of that seawater goes into a tall, thin metal box called a heat exchanger. You know when you open your window in the winter and all of your heat rushes outside? It's trying to warm up the cold air. The same thing happens inside of the heat exchanger. The seawater runs on one side of a titanium plate. On the other side is basically water and antifreeze. The heat from the seawater rushes into the antifreeze mix, warming it up to the same temperature. Schaefermeyer says it then goes into the heat pump, which is run by electricity.
The refrigerant comes into contact with that 47-degree water temperature. It causes it to boil, turns it into a vapor. Then there's compressors in the heat pumps that then compress that vapor, and when you compress a vapor, it gets very hot.
That compressed vapor produces the 120-degree water that heats the building and the pavement. Then the antifreeze loops back to the seawater to start the process all over again. Schaefermeyer says for every unit of energy added to the system, you get out 3 units of heat, and it's more efficient with higher loads. He hopes the technology will be used beyond just the Sea Life Center.
But we want to be able to ultimately see this technology exported into areas where we can heat downtown business districts, heat communities, literally, with this heat.
And it is possible. Andy Baker, the consultant who helped design the center system, says ocean heat pump technology is already widely used in Norway and Sweden. You just need community buy-in and cheap electricity.
If you've got low-cost hydropower and expensive heating oil or propane, that's where you're going to see the heat pumps going in first.
Baker says people in Alaska are even starting to install small-scale projects that work on the same concept but draw heat from the ground or lakes instead. But the technology isn't useful in some of the communities that need it most.
It's tougher because the cost of power is usually a lot higher. The cost of power, for example, in Dutch Harbor is about 42 cents a kilowatt hour. That's more than twice what it is in Seward. So the economics are not nearly as favorable there because of that high cost of power, because it's made from diesel fuel.
But in Seward, where electricity is supplied by Chugach in Anchorage and runs about 12 cents per kilowatt hour, the innovation helps keep Agnes the otter happily swimming and squeaking.
Agnes is a very vocal animal, and it just happens that way.
In Seward, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage-based soldier receives a medal for saving a man from a burning vehicle.
When I was pulling him out, the flames were already coming around the side of the hood. The front of the car was already engulfed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering amenities such as continental breakfast, 24-hour concierge service, and Wi-Fi. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com.
The Department of Defense released a 16-page Arctic strategy document today. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel talked about it at an event in Nova Scotia. The report states the Arctic is at a strategic inflection point, transforming from a region of relative isolation to one of increasing access to resource extraction, fishing, and tourism as sea ice recedes faster than projected. President Obama released a national strategy for the Arctic last May. The Pentagon's desired outcome states it wants an Arctic that is, quote, a secure and stable region where U.S. national interests are safeguarded, the U.S. homeland is protected, and nations work cooperatively to address challenges. The document mentions twice the need to work with the Arctic Council, stating the Council has a demonstrated ability to address a range of soft security issues, such as search and rescue and oil spill response. The Defense Department identifies challenges such as funding cuts that may impact future infrastructure, and taking care not to appear too aggressive in addressing anticipated security risks to avoid the perception that the Arctic is being militarized, which could cause friction with other nations. Links to the document are at our website, alaskapublic.org. The State Department of Transportation began changing speed limit signs this week along the Richardson Highway between Delta Junction and Valdez from 55 to 65 miles per hour. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Transportation Department spokeswoman Hannah Blankenship admits it may seem a bit counterintuitive that the agency is switching out the higher speed limit signs now while the Richardson is coated with ice from last week's storm.
We want to remind the public always that posted speed limits are for ideal conditions, which means dry pavement and definitely not when the roads are covered with ice and snow right now.
Blankenship says the decision to boost the speed limit was made before last week's ice storm and after months of analysis on roadway alignment and terrain, the history of crashes and their severity, and the speed at which motorists were traveling over the Richardson, among other things. She says that study showed many motorists already were driving at 65 along that stretch of the highway. So the higher speed limit would reduce the difference in speeds at which motorists were driving, which should make it safer for all.
Raising the speed limit will reduce the speed disparity between motorists to reduce crashes. So basically, if people are traveling more at the same speed, it's less likely that there will be crashes.
Blankenship says the crews that are swapping out the speed limit signs also will be setting up additional warning signs to advise motorists of school bus stops, curves, and other road conditions. And the Transportation Department will restripe the center line to account for changes in passing zones. The speed limit along a 75-mile stretch on both sides of Isabel Pass, south of Black Rapids, will stay at 55, along with a half-mile stretch just south of Delta. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
50 years ago, when news of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy spread around the world, Alaska's connection to the lower 48 was limited by technology. KUAC's Dan Bross reports on how Fairbanks' newly created public radio station covered the story.
KUAC was a fledgling station back in 1963, having gone on the air just a year earlier. It was operated out of a tiny studio on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus, and on the morning of November 22nd, when the news of the JFK assassination first broke, student volunteer Tom Jensen was at the controls.
There was a small red light on the console in front of the announcer, and if it started blinking, that meant major story news bulletin coming in.
Jensen says he was just into the first hour of his shift when the light started to blink, and he ran to grab copy printing out on the teletype machine.
The bulletin said, President John F. Kennedy has been shot in Dallas, Texas. He's on his way to Parkland General Hospital. More news when it's available. I broke in on the air. That was a news bulletin. Read it to the listening audience. Went back to recorded music, classical music, and called the station manager, which is what you did if you were an 18-year-old kid. He said, keep monitoring the wire. I'm on my way in to take over.
Jensen says a second bulletin saying the president was dead came in about an hour later, just as the station manager arrived.
And what he did is he placed a long-distance call, which back then wasn't all that easy. You had to have operator assistance. It was about $5 a minute was the cost, to the public station in Seattle, and made arrangements to have them feed on that phone line their live coverage.
Jensen says KUAC was the first of Fairbanks' three radio stations to go live with coverage from the lower 48. He says he was dispatched onto campus with a portable tape recorder to gather reactions to the assassination, and looking back says what he found was very representative of people in the remote new state.
There was no show of emotion, outward emotion, tears, crying, sobbing, as we saw later on broadcast coverage from the lower 48. I don't mean that Alaskans were disrespectful or that they didn't care. That wasn't true. But we didn't feel connected, I don't think, to the lower 48. What happened politically in Washington was so far away, we were kind of like the stepchild.
Jensen says television news about the assassination did not air on local stations until the next day, when tape from the lower 48 was flown in. He says he regrets that KUAC's radio coverage wasn't recorded.
I wasn't mature enough, old enough at that time to really think about its historical significance. I was more concerned with not, excuse the expression, screwing it up.
Tom Jensen went on to serve in Vietnam, then returned to Alaska, where he worked in broadcasting and telecommunications. He currently lives in Anchorage. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A J-Bear soldier was awarded the highest military honor for an act of heroism in a non-war setting yesterday. Sergeant First Class John Kearns received the Soldier's Medal for pulling a man from a burning car after it crashed and before it exploded a few moments later. A paratrooper with the 4th Infantry Brigade Combat Team 25th Infantry Division, Kearns was driving on Interstate 95 near the Virginia-North Carolina state line in 2011 when he saw a car veer off the highway and crash into trees. Kearns ran to the upside-down vehicle. He says the doors were locked, but most of the glass was broken out of the burning, still-running car. The driver was incapacitated, and the seatbelts would not release.
I had to physically cut his seatbelt off and pull him from the front two seats of the car into the back of the car to go ahead and pull him out.
Kern says he doesn't remember making any deliberate decisions about what he should do, but it was clear the car was going to explode.
When I was pulling him out, the flames were already coming around the side of the hood. The front of the car was already engulfed. And when I opened the other door to pull him out, I was asking for help from some of the other people there. There was a Federal Express employee, and there was another person approached when the tires started to pop. That was the end of my help. They dispersed.
The last thing Kearns did before getting clear of the burning car was grab the man's cell phone.
I remember thinking to myself that you know, this guy's had a pretty bad day. The only thing that's going to make it any worse would be to lose all those phone numbers.
Kern says the man was convulsing when he reached the car, and he suspects that he was having a seizure. That probably caused the crash. But it's unlikely that he'll ever know for sure. He found out from the hospital that the man was recovering, but he never found out who he had saved. The Soldier's Medal is awarded only for saving a life without regard to losing your own.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lisa Fu. Today on AK, City Under One Roof. It takes a different kind of person to live in Whittier, Alaska. The town is accessible only by water or by tunnel, the weather is extreme, and the only housing option is an ugly apartment building. But the community has managed to win over grade school teacher Erica Thompson. Alaska Public Media's video producer, Travis Gilmore, spent a day with Thompson and found out life in this one-building town is unique, even by Alaska's standards.
I turned the camera on as soon as I entered the 2.5-mile-long tunnel that leads to the town of Whittier. I assume we're setting out to capture footage for a story about isolation. Then I meet Erica Thompson.
You know, Whittier's different than, say, working in the traditional bush community in that, you know, we are on the road, but we all live in the same building.
Thompson has lived in Whittier for 4 years. She teaches second, third, and fourth grade at the Whittier School, which happens to be across the street from the building that houses most of Whittier's residents. Erica takes an elevator to the basement floor, then walks through the underground tunnel.
I think in a larger community, you know, you go to school, you travel there, and not in Whittier. You know, you just got to walk over, and it takes 5 minutes, if that, you know, depending on the elevator, of course.
Erica lives high up in the Begich Towers, a large pastel building that looks like it'd be more at home in New Jersey than small-town Alaska. It has 196 apartment units, most of which are occupied by Whittier's year-round residents. And when you live down the hall from your students, some of the usual boundaries can get blurry.
No.
What floor do you guys need?
11.
5 and 11?
Yeah, he moved.
Oh. It's like a family. You know, I don't have discipline issues. I don't have classroom management issues because they know me. It's like coming to school with mom. They call me mom half the time anyway.
Begich Towers is often called the city under one roof. Tucked in its 14 floors are some amenities you might not expect to find.
We have everything we need, really. There's a post office downstairs. There's a grocery store downstairs. There's a little video store that if you want to rent videos or movies, you can go and call her and she'll come over. City offices are downstairs as well, so all the city managers and everything and the mayor work down there. So you don't have to leave if you don't need to.
For some residents, not having to leave the building can be more of a burden than a convenience.
It's hard to stay healthy in a town like this. Our weather is really challenging. We don't have a fitness center or a gym. Between the extreme winds and the rain and the snow, that challenges a lot of people. And so I think that it just becomes a normal thing to not move and to not be healthy. And the weather is always a great excuse.
And that's something Erica's trying to counteract with her students as well as with her adult neighbors.
Keep those eyes on the ceiling, chin going towards the ceiling.
After school is out for the day, she runs home to change, take her dog out for a quick walk, and then she hits the gym. The school gym, that is.
I'm on 15 if you're following my count. I had a lot of community members asking me to teach classes. Last year, I was convinced by just enough people asking that I decided to try it. And it has gone really well, and it's really well received. And like I said, I love watching people meet their goals. And so to watch someone start the school year off and not be able to do something and finish the school year off and to be able to do it and more is really rewarding for me.
And that neighborly spirit, it makes Whittier a little bit less isolating than it may seem.
It would be silly to say that you live a lonely life living in the building, because I have friends and neighbors and students and coworkers that are right down the hall.
Did you get it?
Yeah.
Nice.
All of them.
Did Austin help you?
No.
Actually, did Batman help you?
No.
No Batman?
Yeah.
If you're having a bad day, if you're having a day where you think, gosh, I haven't talked to another human being for a while, you can just walk down the hall or you can get in the elevator.
This Christmas, Erica's treating herself to a trip that's a little farther than an elevator ride to a neighbor's apartment. After 4 years straight in Whittier, she's finally taking a vacation out of state. For AK, I'm Travis Gilmore.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're going to Southwest Alaska, where a self-sufficient couple make up the entire year-round population of Portage Creek. The community is a speck on the map about 30 miles southeast of Dillingham.
My name is Chris Carr. I live in Portage Creek, Alaska. With my wife, we run the Portage Creek General Store and Lodge, and I'm a registered big game guide. Yeah, currently it's just my wife and I that live here. The main significance of Porter Creek these days is the king salmon fishing. We have the number one running king salmon run going up the New Shack right in front of the house. The moose season, that's kind of a rat race. We get hundreds and hundreds of people during the moose season. I tend to forget about that. If the caribou come through, we'll see people from Dillingham come through. You know, the price of living out here is way up there. I mean, everything we make goes into surviving the winter, basically fuel and food. You know, I think gas in town of Dillingham there is, you know, 6:30 or something like that. So people don't travel as much as they used to. We're pretty much isolated, but we like it. We have lots of wildlife that roam through the yard. Got a couple cows and calves in the yard right now. We were a vibrant kind of village, you know, 10 years ago almost. We had a school, one classroom school. It was pretty nice, you know. The kids got a great education. But the kids grew up and couldn't get any recruits, and the village council moved to Anchorage, so we got stranded. You know, it's peaceful, it's quiet, lots of wildlife. We like it that way. You know, like I say, we're not really into the rat race.
Chris Carr lives in Portage Creek with his wife, Leona. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want your community profiled on the show, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Travis Gilmore, Slavik Boyechko, Monica Goki, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Ann Hillman reported from Seward. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank of Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for more than 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.